Hey there, everybody. It is that time again for Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, politics editor here at KQED.
I'm Marisa Lagos, a KQED politics reporter. Sometimes I analyze stuff.
Schmoozer.
I think hard. Today on The Breakdown, we have attorney Anne Ravel. She is a good government and elections law expert who served on the ethics commissions at both the state and federal level. She's going to tell us what that means.
What that means. And you may remember, those who follow these kinds of things, that she left the Federal Elections Commission with a bang. And we're going to ask her about things like that and the online political ad world. Maybe Stormy Daniels. We may get into that. Why she went to war with the commission that she was leading. Not Stormy Daniels, but Anne Ravel.
Well, anytime we can get Stormy Daniels in, I guess it's a good day.
Yeah, it's good for the ratings, right?
I guess. But first, let's talk about some stuff closer to home. We've had a lot of drama. This governor's race is heating up.
It is Lord of the Flies time. They're turning on each other. But first, let's talk about
Let's explain why.
So there have been polls, and virtually every poll for the last 2 years has shown Gavin Newsom, the Democrat lieutenant governor, in first place. And PPIC poll out this week had him again in first place, 25%, followed by John Cox, the Republican.
Who?
John Cox, the Republican, and the preferred choice of the real Donald Trump, by the way. He's at 19% in that poll. Antonio Villaraigosa at 15%. Travis Allen, assemblyman from OC, 11%. John Chung, 9%. And then 15% undecided. And why does that—
All of this matter.
All of it matter? Well, of course, we have a top two primary here in California, which means, irrespective of party, the top two finishers go on to November and a slugfest. And so you've got people firing in all directions.
It is so insane out there. Like, my email inbox, I can't even keep track of, like, who's aligned with whom and who's attacking whom. So I'll run down a couple of ones that caught my eye. We've seen, first of all, and this has been out for a week or so, but this ad by Newsom trying to sort of attack, quote unquote, air quotes, John Cox, but really read between the lines, they're trying to prop him up.
Saying he's against gun control.
Yeah, he's
with
the
NRA. Which is a red meat for the right wing.
And then you have, you know, a Villaraigosa-backed group backing Villaraigosa independent expenditure campaign, backed mostly by charter school advocates, who are now trying to prop up Travis Allen, the Republican, in an attempt to hurt John Cox so that Villaraigosa makes it in. Are you following
here?
We need a chart. John Chung's just attacking everyone.
Well, then you've got Cox and Travis Allen kind of going after each other. You know, Travis Allen's whole point is that he's the real Donald Trump supporter. He voted for Donald Trump. And, of course, John Cox didn't. He said during the debate that he didn't think he was conservative enough.
But then he got his endorsement last week.
He got his endorsement.
Not the best day for Travis.
Yeah, and clearly I think you've got to figure that Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader in the House, who's very concerned about holding on to the majority, got to the president and said, hey, we've got to have a Republican at the top of the ticket in November or we're going to not have a great turnout and that could hurt the House seats.
You know, they went to D.C. at the beginning of May, Cox and his campaign, I think, for these conversations. I mean, the other interesting thing to me, though, is like how this is splitting the Democrats, because you do have, you know, these charter school advocates, some more conservative voices backing Villaraigosa, including former gubernatorial hopeful Meg Whitman and Steve Wesley, who also lost, both Republicans. Who lost gubernatorial? Right.
Steve Wesley's a Democrat.
Self-funded. That's
self-funded.
What I'm going with.
He's rich. Rich guys.
But yeah, they're holding a fundraiser for Villaraigosa. And I mean, it really, this top two primary system is creating some odd bedfellows. And I think making it kind of confusing for voters.
Yeah. You know, has Arnold Schwarzenegger endorsed anybody? I can't imagine he would endorse either of these Republicans, right?
He's been at war with them.
He'd been in war with them, Meg Whitman. You know, the Republicans kind of feel that they're both rhinos anyway, Meg Whitman and Schwarzenegger. So at this point, he hasn't made an endorsement. But it's kind of crazy.
And then there's another race where there's some firing.
Sparks. Yeah, the attorney general race where we've got Javier Becerra running and lots of ads for him, including some where he's walking through the state Supreme Court building. And Dave Jones, who's now desperate to get some free media, filed a complaint with the FPPC, I think, on Monday, and then he filed a lawsuit today saying he didn't have a permit to film in the state Supreme Court building.
So that one's interesting.
But he did have a permit. I mean, that's sort
yeah,
of
they're
the point
saying he
Becerra
had a permit. I think he's trying to argue that this is more like inappropriate because you're using a government building and you're a government official. But, you know, this all tracks back to a year and a half ago when Governor Jerry Brown dashed Dave Jones' hopes and appointed Becerra to the AG position.
That was not a good day for Dave Jones.
And so, yeah, it is like, it. You know, again, I mean, my mailbox, I don't know about yours, is overflowing every day. We're not even talking about, like, the San Francisco issues that we both live here. And I will say, shout out, I'm asking folks to send me their best political mailers from around the state.
Interesting, kind of offbeat. Yeah.
Whatever you think.
Yeah, send it our way.
Send it our way.
Hey, before we get to our guest, one more thing about the polls. You know, there's been all this talk about a blue wave, you know, big turnout among Democrats, going to sweep some incumbent Republicans out of their congressional seats. Maybe not so much. That poll, that PPIC poll, took a look at the most competitive races, the ones Democrats are targeting, the ones the Cook Report kind of calls toss-up or lean or likely. And 2-1, voters prefer the Republican generic candidate in those districts to the Democrat. 2-1.
Yeah, that's not good for Democrats. But I will say it is generic. We do not know who's going to be right in most of those races. You do have two Ed Royce and Daryl Issa seats in Orange County.
And some seats that are really a huge reach for Democrats, like the McClintock seat, you know, that really is rock-ribbed Republican. And so that, you know, that.
Right. I was just going to say that Royce and Issa, those guys are bound out. They're retiring. So you will not have an incumbent in those. I mean, I think it's easy for us to sort of lump all of these together, but I do think that congressional districts, you know, local elections are totally different. And I think that's what you see is that people, you know, sort of hate Congress generally, but maybe like their own congressperson.
And of course, the big risk for Democrats is that they get squeezed out of the top two. And, you know, we'll see how that plays out. We will no doubt be talking about that probably a couple of weeks from now. But right now, we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to be joined by attorney Ann Ravel. You're listening to Political Breakdown on KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I am Marisa Lagos, along with Scott Schaefer. And joining us now is a woman who actually understands the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, and we assume other Byzantine election laws.
Yeah, she is, was the FPPC chair, the watchdog for California's political and finance system, and was appointed to the FEC by President Obama. She quit in protest, and now she's on the steering committee for the Voters' Right to Know Project. Ann Ravel, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You got a long resume there. There's a lot of details.
That's the least of it.
I know, right? We just covered like the last 10 years, I think, mostly, because you worked in Santa Clara for a long time as the county lawyer.
Yes, I did. I was also at the Department of Justice at the beginning.
We want to get into that stuff.
Okay.
But I do want to ask you first, can you just explain, like, when we say you are an elections expert, you've served on these commissions, what does that mean? Like, how do you explain this to someone at a dinner party?
Or do you?
I try not to. But I do kind of what you did at the beginning of the hour, which is talk about political issues, and I see it with a campaign finance lens, unfortunately.
Why do you say unfortunately?
Well, because I'm so focused on the issues of campaign finance and of transparency that it's really important to me. So I see everything through that lens. In fact, that's why Stormy Daniels was so interesting.
And we'll come back to Stormy. Yes. Were you, like, just as a kid, were you like a numbers? Did you like numbers and math and, you know, paying it?
The opposite. I didn't like numbers or math.
Because there's a lot of numbers in campaign finance.
There is, if what you do is the actual sort
addition
of looking at those issues. If what you care about is the policy and what it means for democracy, as I do, and I think of campaign finance more as consumer protection, and I care a lot about that. So that's why I'm interested in it.
I mean, and you're a lawyer, so you understand, like we said, you understand these things. But I understand as a kid, your family was fairly political. You moved around quite a bit. Your mother's Brazilian, I think. So tell me about, like, was this something that you guys would sit around at, you know, the dinner table talking politics with your family?
Absolutely. We sat around the dinner table talking about politics. And one of my earliest memories is seeing the Democratic convention when I was about two or three, I think, on TV, and having, I mean, my parents talking about it consistently.
So they were liberal?
They, well, I wouldn't say liberal exactly, but they were obviously sort of more, say, compassionate Democrats.
Yeah, and you lived in Brazil for a bit?
I lived in Chile.
Oh, in Chile.
My mother is Brazilian. My parents met in Latin America. I now wonder whether my father was perhaps doing something other than being a meteorologist when we lived in Chile.
Like
potentially being CIA.
Really?
Which I, of course, no one ever told me that. And my parents, both my parents died fairly young, so I never had an opportunity to ask about it.
Was he there during the Allende years?
Well, it was before Allende was elected, although Allende had run for office for president when we were there.
Did you ever ask your mom?
No. Well, and my mother died soon thereafter, and I never asked her. But you know what made me think about it was I was—
Why would a meteorologist be in right.
Well,
Latin
no.
America?
That didn't— he said he was setting up weather stations in Chile and worked out of the embassy. But then I realized when after I was at the DOJ— that a lot of people that work out of embassies are actually not doing ambassadorial kind of work.
You could do a FOIA request.
And I'm planning to do that at some point. When we came back from Chile, he was working as a meteorologist, I presume.
with air quotes.
Yes, in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which I have been told by a former attorney general in Arizona is the place where they do CIA training.
Interesting.
Oh my
is that
gosh.
Janet Napolitano? No.
No, it is not Janet Napolitano.
Okay, well, that throws me for a loop. This was not expecting
you
didn't
where are we
expect
going?
Me to say this. I'm sorry.
No, it's fabulous. That's like one of the best, like, surprising answers we've got on this show, I feel like. All right, well, let's move into more recent
teenage years.
Yeah. So when you're sort of longest job was, as I mentioned, in Santa Clara, working up through the county council's office. And I know that one of your biggest cases was this lead paint case, which is like, I don't know, 18 years old at this point. But it's still happening and it's still political. Tell us about, like, what did you guys win in that case and why is it still in the news?
Right. The case was filed in 2000 when I first became the county council. And what I started was a group similar to what they have in San Francisco to do affirmative litigation. And it came to my attention through the county health department, public health, that there's still a really big problem with lead paint poisoning, particularly in low-income communities in Santa Clara County. So, and I knew that there had been one case that didn't succeed, filed. And so we decided to go forward and file it. And it was the first case that ever succeeded ultimately in getting a judgment to clean up lead paint poisoning.
And you filed it against the paint company?
Yes. There were a number of paint companies that were the defendants. A Santa Clara County judge awarded, and I think it was $1.3 billion.
With a B.
But this was not just for Santa Clara. A number of cities and counties also joined. Although I have to say, this was my first introduction to politics in a nasty sense, because when I was talking to the other counties to get them to join the case, I was told that the paint companies hired lobbyists who went around to all those cities, bigger cities and counties, smaller other counties other than the ones that joined, telling them that if they joined that suit, that they were going to run people against them.
Wow.
So, sorry, just quickly, that this judgment is basically going to be before voters this fall, right? They're running a ballot measure that would essentially shift these cleanup costs on to the public through bond measures and basically say that—
No liability, right?
Yeah.
Going forward.
Right. Yes. The paint companies, although one has recently settled, or I don't know if it's been approved by the court yet, but one settled, but the paint companies have a $6 million war chest to get signatures on a ballot measure that they're putting on the ballot in in the fall to essentially eliminate not only that case, but to prevent any other future cases for lead paint cleanup in the state of California.
So this is kind of like the new tobacco company issue?
It's very much like the tobacco company, in fact. And the problem with it, of course, is that they're then asking the state of California for bond money, which means taxpayer money, interest on top of it to do the cleanup. And the thing that is really upsetting about this is that they're characterizing it in a way that is absolutely outrageous, as far as I'm concerned. And they call it the Safe Schools and Homes Act, and that they're going to do much more cleanup of environmental hazards, and that they're concerned about these issues.
Although the title and summary are quite different from that the Attorney General came out with.
Yes.
So when voters look at when it's on the ballot, they'll see something different than that.
Yes, they will. But they're making some arguments that might be convincing to people, such as that individuals might have responsibility anyway because of the way that the judgment was, which is not the case.
Well, that gets us to the rest of what you do, which is money and politics and confusing voters.
Yes, it is. And let me just say that it's really fascinating that one of the groups, in fact, the company that settled, had given money relating to a similar issue in Wisconsin and gave a lot of money to Scott Walker. Then immediately thereafter, the legislature and Scott Walker signed a bill that was a funding bill that snuck in it that there was going to be no ability to bring cases for lead paint poisoning. And in fact, any cases that existed were null and void.
So this is happening in other states.
It has happened. It happened quite some time ago. And that matter is now, there was recently a release of a lot of information about Scott Walker to The Guardian. So it's very interesting to see that
there's kind of a playbook here.
A playbook.
Yeah. Just for our listeners who are joining us late, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio, and we're talking to former FEC chairwoman Ann Ravel.
We should talk about that.
Let's talk about the FEC. Yeah. So just before we get to Washington, you were in Sacramento. You were the head of the FPPC, California's political watchdog. And how would you compare, the climate, the transparency, the issues generally in Sacramento versus D.C.?
It's like night and day. Sacramento.
Which one's night?
The place I escaped from, D.C., is night. And Sacramento was day. Because there was a lot of bipartisan discussion and agreement on transparency in California. And I did not find it to be problematic. Obviously, talking to the Republicans, and I was a Jerry Brown appointee, but the Republicans were really amenable to the entire construct, and they did not want to undermine it. We might not have had agreement on specific regulations, but for the most part, there was an understanding that the mission was appropriate.
And the mission being that there should be sunshine in politics and political spending, essentially?
Yes.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and right before I left the FPPC, we had litigation over Prop 30 and 32.
Yeah, we were going to bring that up.
Okay.
Let's just get some background there. Right. That was was it $11 million contribution, late contribution that came in on behalf of a ballot measure to limit the amount of money unions could put into politics and against a temporary tax increase to pay for education and teachers?
It was $11 million until the FPPC ultimately investigated it, and then we determined it was $15 million.
And the issue was we didn't know where it was coming from.
No, we didn't. And there was a complaint that was filed because this money came in late. It was given by a group in Arizona which had never participated. It was a 501c4, never participated in a campaign in California before, dropped the $11 million. And the only information we had about it was that there was a treasurer for the, or representative of that group in Virginia, and all we knew about him was that he shared an office with Karl Rove.
Now, pull back the curtain a little bit.
Okay.
How does it happen that you take the ball and run with that? Who called you? Who talked to you? Did the governor talk to you? Did the attorney general, Kamala Harris, talk to
you? Did you read the newspaper?
Right. A complaint was filed, and the complaint was filed by Common Cause, primarily, mm-hmm. and also, I think, the unions joined.
And the Common Cause is a good government group,
basically. It is a good government group. And, of course, the FPPC has to investigate the complaints. But what was clear to me was, because the complaint was filed about 2 weeks before the election, that in order to determine who was really behind this contribution and whether or not they complied with California's disclosure laws, that we had to act quickly. And so we filed litigation right away.
But
the governor did not talk to me.
But we didn't really find out the true source until after the election.
That's correct. What we did find out, though, and that case, it was really unusual because it went to the California Supreme Court, who met on Sunday, a rare Sunday court session, and unanimously they decided that this group had to turn over all their information, all their documents to the FPPC.
So for the average person, explain why that's important.
Why it's important
to know
the money's coming from.
It's so important to know where the money's coming from, because in order to vote and understand who's behind some of these either candidates or particularly ballot measures where the people are sitting as the legislature for the day. And so you have to know who's trying to influence the election and to influence your views. I think disclosure is one of the most important aspects of campaign finance law. And you know, the Supreme Court has said that the whole purpose of disclosure is for people to be able to determine if there's corruption as well. And corruption is the basis for campaign finance laws.
Well, one big area we're hearing about in terms of influence on the 2016 election is obviously online and how we think Russia, used platforms like Facebook to sort of influence voters in a number of ways. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that there's basically no regulation on the federal level of online political activity. So I guess, you know, you've been talking about this for several years prior to the 2015 election. What do you make of sort of it feels to me like there's been this almost collective shrug on the part of the American people over this.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the fact that people don't seem to be enraged about this.
Why do you think that is?
I think in some ways people have become inured to some of these issues. There's so much coming at them that they don't care so much. And also, I mean, you saw from the election, just from what Bernie Sanders was saying and what Trump was saying, that appealed to people, is that people already think that institutions aren't important and they don't respond to people.
Right, cynicism. Sorry.
Right. Well, they think the political system is already corrupt, and so they're not that excited about it. I'll tell you something. I was shocked in my class at Berkeley Law School we talked about Russian intervention in the election, and a number of them said, why is that so important? We don't care.
Really? Mm. Law students. Mm.
Huh. They want to move on.
Well, they thought that it was just other people communicating.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have just like 4 minutes left, and we haven't talked about the FEC much. Yeah, time flies.
I know.
Plus, you had four lattes today, and that, you know, so everything just speeded up.
We haven't talked about Stormy.
And I had a quad cap.
I know. Stormy.
But let's just you go from the FPPC in Sacramento to DC. President Obama appoints mm-hmm. you to the FEC, and of course, they have three Republicans and three Democrats. What did you think you could accomplish?
I believed that because we had some people who were difficult on the FPPC also, but that I figured out how to talk to them and how to get unanimous votes to agree to do
things. You thought
things.
You could do that.
I thought I could do that at the FEC. And I also thought that disclosure, after all, is kind of the basic thing.
Were you naive looking back on it?
No question.
A little bit.
I was unbelievably naive.
Yeah, and so it seemed like your tenure was really marked by a lack of sort of activity at the FEC and not doing anything. I guess I'm curious if, you know, you were empress for the day and you could throw away all of the rules and regulations and start from scratch. Like, what do you think is the most important thing that we could do as a nation to ensure the kind of, you know, sunshine that you're talking about?
Right. Well, I definitely think that now, since all the political activity that really is meaningful is on the internet, and it is so easy on the platforms, as you mentioned, to not be transparent and to not know who's behind things, that's what we have to do now. That's the one thing that I think is going to lead us to a lot of problems if we don't do it.
Excuse me, I thought you would say public financing of campaigns.
You know, I do think public financing of campaigns of some sort, matching funds or some kind of public financing, I actually think that what we really need is to figure out ways to get more people engaged in the political process and to not feel so disassociated from their communities that they don't think that they have an ability to make a change.
So you're sort of agnostic about public financing? Surprised you just don't seem very enthusiastic.
Well, I think a lot of people don't believe in it, and therefore I'm a pragmatist. I'm old. I want to get things done that might happen, you know. And so I do think at local levels there will be more of it, like Seattle and other places, absolutely. Not on the federal level. Yeah.
All right, before we go, yes or no, was the Stormy Daniels thing, is that a campaign finance question?
It is a campaign finance question in part, of course. It's also a moral question. But I do think that what needs to happen is an investigation of it to find out. I mean, just on the face of it, so much of it was lying that you have to realize that one of those stories is not true.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Anne Rabel, thanks so much for coming in. And tell us when you get that FOIA report on your
dad. Yeah, I want to hear about that.
All right. That does it. You shouldn't have mentioned that. No, that was great.
All that time.
All right. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you like what you heard today, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. And for more elections coverage, of course, you can check out KQED's brand new elections page with profiles of gubernatorial candidates and more. That's at kqed.org/elections.
Our producer tonight is Jeremy Siegel and our engineer is Seal Muller. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can follow me on Twitter at @mlagos.
I'm Scott Schaefer. I don't know why I always jump on your lines at that point, but follow me on Twitter. I'm @Scott Schaefer. That's a wrap for Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.